Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and this time we're chatting about The Garden of Darkness by Gillian Murray Kendall from 2014. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam. Welcome to our podcast about The Garden of Darkness by Gillian Murray Kendall, which is our first outing into post-apocalyptic fiction on this podcast, with the exception of The Chrysalids, but that's more post-post-apocalypse. This is immediately post-apocalypse. Everyone's dead. Small band of survivors, and so on.
Yeah, so survivalist fiction, I'd almost call it.
Yeah. It's like The Walking Dead with kids.
Yeah, I think that's pretty dead on, actually.
Yeah, it's like The Road without the product placement.
What's the product placement to again?
Oh, a refreshing can of Coca-Cola.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Well, you can imagine that if anything was to survive the apocalypse, it would be a sturdy can of Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
So how did you come across this book?
Well, there's not much of a story to it.
Invent some details.
I was on a long, deserted, dusty road, backpack on my back, flask of water nearly empty. The crows were circling overhead. I saw what looked like a patch of grass. I thought maybe I could suck some dew from the leaves. When I looked down, there was a paperback book instead, and it was this book, and that's how I found it.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And presumably you made it back to civilization.
Yeah, and I did, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All's well that ends well.
Yep.
And presumably it's not a terribly old book, right?
It came out in 2014, and it's not very well known either. It's I think it's quite a small press. Sort of thing.
Which is surprising, perhaps, considering the popularity of post-apocalyptic films, at least, and video games in, I suppose, over the last decade.
Mm.
Obviously, you referred to The Road earlier. Also, think of the Fallout games, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I guess, the similarity of series like The Hunger Games or The Maze Runner to the post-apocalyptic genre.
Yeah.
Which are effectively survivalist and have elements of the dystopian post-apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It definitely feels sort of quite timely that there would be a young adult. Well, I'm sure there's a few, but a young adult survivalist post-apocalyptic novel.
Yeah, especially with the increased youth concern around climate change.
Mm.
I've been a bit involved with Extinction Rebellion over the last year, but certainly you see with the school strikes on Fridays that the real push towards climate change activism is coming from the young.
Mm. Yeah. Not that this directly deals with with climate change, but...
No, post-apocalyptic novels don't, and I don't know if that's kind of a hang-up of a nuclear age, or a kind of disavowal of not wanting to think too much about the impending horrors of climate change.
So what the threat is in this book is a disease called Sitka AZ-13, but known as pest.
Which I think somewhat undersells it, like, oh, it's just a pest.
Yeah.
Get pest control in, it's fine.
Yeah. It kills all adults and most children, but a few children have delayed onset pest, which means that they have a few years of reprieve before succumbing to the full disease in their late teens.
Yeah, originally, across the first few chapters, I thought it was that, bang, as soon as a kid hits 18, they're an adult, they get pest, or that the symptoms suddenly kick in. And I think that's sort of how it's written early on, that there is this hard line in the sand. But actually later we discover that there are 16 and 17-year-olds who find that the disease sets in fully before they turn 18, and indeed some kids who turn 18 become legal adults and still survive for a year or two afterwards. So I thought that was interesting, because it seems to kind of dramatise this split between whether childhood or the point at which a child becomes an adult is something that exists out there in the material world, that it's an immutable law of nature, whether it is something more constructed, and if so, what does it mean for a child to become an adult? And certainly, what does it mean in a society where there are no longer laws?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our protagonist, Claire, is 15. She was a cheerleader in the pre-pest world. And she's one of these survivors, obviously. She watches her father and her stepmother die of pest, and then sort of tries to survive on her own in a sort of holiday home outside of the city. Unnamed city, but assuming North American somewhere.
Well, it's definitely not in Britain, I know that much, because there are dogs with rabies, and I always rest secure in the knowledge that British dogs don't have rabies. Which is good, it helps me leave the house in the morning.
That's good.
I will note that there's a friendly companion dog in this book, who is perhaps the most terrifying aspect of it, frankly. I know it's meant to be a good dog, you know, it's a loyal dog, but...
Maybe a gigantic and easily provoked dog is a good companion in the post-apocalyptic world, but I don't find it very reassuring.
Probably more useful than a cat, I'd say, in terms of, say, scavenging or fending off attackers, but I think...
I mean, I don't know, like, have you ever brought a cat to the vets? I'd have like a gigantic cat, like I think that'd be quite effective.
Okay.
Anyway,
like a panther,
like a panther, or just like a really big house cat.
Yeah,
that would be my ideal post-apocalyptic companion.
I mean, my default is toucan, because I like toucans a lot, but apart from being able to swallow grapes in one go.
I would keep the morale up, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly, keep the morale up. And, you know, that's what you've got to watch out for, really, is the morale. You know, because you may find that you've got enough water, but, you know, there are rivers, but what's the natural source for morale?
Toucans.
Toucans, yeah.
So Claire and her alarmingly big dog go scavenging in a nearby town, where they meet 13-year-old Jem, who was at the same school as Claire, and two younger girls, Miri and Saray, who Jem is looking after he found them. And the four of them band together and essentially look for a cure for pest before Claire gets it.
Yeah, before she's bested by pest. Mm. Pested.
And they face hazards as well as finding sufficient food and water and shelter in the shape of the cured, who are people who took up a supposed cure for pest, but which changed their personalities and made them violent and unpredictable.
Yeah, they're kind of zany zombies.
Mm.
Zombies that are a bit kookier.
Yeah, they talk.
I guess. Mm. Like, to varying degrees of comprehensibility.
Yeah. But yeah, they. Yeah, there does seem to be quite a wide spectrum of normal seemingness.
Yeah, among yeah. The cured. Like, there are some who you'll approach and they'll just be like, "Oh, fiddledy foe, I'll eat your face in one go." And then there are others who'll be like, "Yeah, I'm not a pest. No, honestly, just looking out for myself." Oh, and then suddenly you find in the night they're chewing on your elbow or something. Yeah. And yeah, and it turns out they were doing a very good job at pretending.
Mm.
And you go, "Oh, you pest." Oh, you darn pests.
Yeah, and the gang's one clue in the search for a cure is a looping radio message, which is the one radio frequency that isn't static, and it's looping this message. "I am the master of the situation. If you are alive, you are a child, and when you come of age, you will die of pest. This is what the pest rash means. But I can cure you. Come to me, north of Hearn Wood, near Route 180. North of Hearn Wood, near Route 180, I am the only adult left." And probably because he's called, all he's known as is Master, or Master of the Situation, self-proclaimed, I pictured him as the Demon Headmaster. the text of this podcast.
Or John Major.
Alternatively, John Major, yeah. As we started with the Demon Headmaster, everything must return to the Demon Headmaster.
Everything returns to the source.
And so the Master is the other part of the novel, and we're sort of split between the group of children and their journeys and trials, and
I notice you were careful not to call him the other protagonist.
Yeah. I tried that, and then I thought, no, that's too wrong.
Other relatable human guy.
Spoiler, he's not a relatable human guy.
No, as people who call themselves the Master so seldom are.
But we see his perspective as he enacts his plan to collect the surviving children for his own unsavoury desires. Pretty unsavoury, let me tell you.
Yeah, pretty unsavoury.
So, you were saying that you don't think this is horror.
Okay. I generally don't see the survivalist or post-apocalyptic genre as horror. Mm. So, if we think of, say, famous post-apocalyptic films, like the Mad Max films, mm-hmm. for instance, I think we'd consider those action films foremost. If we're thinking of A Boy and His Dog, maybe a sort of darkly comic, misogynist sci-fi, but not really a horror. And I think the reason for that is because generally the protagonists of survivalist films or stories are too equipped and capable.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not equipped and capable, you've probably died off in the early stages, like I would
do. Well, yeah. I mean...
So...
I quite firmly believe that I would be a miscellaneous corpse littering the road, while the capable people made bandages out of elastic bands or whatever they do.
And ferns.
Ferns and elastic bands.
Yeah, bracken.
They'd kick my corpse aside and be like, oh dear, they didn't know how to do this.
Do those adult things. And,
bet they had a podcast, but that's all they knew how to do. Anyway.
But I think maybe, so, okay, not so much with the Box of Delights, but with most of the children's texts we've looked at so far, protagonists, while plucky, are often beset by anxiety and worry or, you know, generally... I just don't think the kids in this struggle enough, really. And maybe that just makes me an orphan sadist. But, like, things go pretty well. Like, every time something seems to go very badly wrong, generally it picks up pretty fast. Like, I guess it's also that the survival genre necessitates mission-based plotting. So, yes, there's the encroachment of chaos, right, in... the form of pest or whatever nasty apocalyptic deus ex machina you need. But generally the characters are very focused on how they're going to solve this situation, what they're going to do about it. Like, they have strategies and action plans in place. And yes, sometimes there'll be some hiccups along the road, but generally they'll know what they're doing or what they're aiming for. Whereas I think, for me, in horror, the chaos needs to kind of seep into the psychology of the characters more, and there needs to be a sense of things spiralling out of control. Mm. Whereas I guess, with a post-apocalyptic text, the spiralling out of control's already happened.
Yep.
You know, that's been and gone. So we kind of post-horror, in a sense... it's like I remember watching Dawn of the Dead, the original, with my old housemate Stu, which I was quite fond of as a teenager, and I played it to him, and he said, yeah, it was good, but it wasn't a horror film. And at the time I was confused, because it's zombies, and, you know, that so it's a horror film. But he said, yeah, but it's more of an action film, because the characters are constantly talking about how they're securing the base, and, you know, how they're getting from A to B, from this... hold out to this gun cache, and then what they're going to do when they're there, and that it tends to be very much based around their actions and what they're going to do, rather than the psychology so much.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my case for it not being horror.
Yeah, I mean, these are remarkably capable children.
Yeah.
They know how to, they like do like basic medical things and like boil water, dig toilets, make weapons. Yeah.
All the things that like our parents' generation or maybe the generation before them did, but you know, we don't really. Really need to do those things. So
they do feel like, you do kind of feel like they will probably be okay.
Yeah, there is peril,
but
you feel like they're going to deal with it.
I think that's a good case. It doesn't, but on the other hand, it does hit on a lot of horror tropes. over the course of the novel. Okay, this is alphabetically. So we have blood drinking, body horror, cannibalism, child murder, creepy dolls, cults, disfigurement, decaying corpses, eugenics, feral children, mass suicide, paedophilia, psychopathy, serial killers, and teenage pregnancy. Maybe other people aren't as scared of pregnancy as I am, so... But, yeah. So, you know, that's quite a list.
Yeah, that is a fair point. I suppose the maison scène of... Sorry, I've been lecturing all afternoon. Of the book is pretty creepy and horror themed. Yeah, I mean, I guess if you had different characters thrown into this environment, I'd feel it was more of a horror. I mean, occasionally you do encounter children who have, you know, met worse fates, or, you know, spoiler warning, not all the kids survive, but the kids that are our protagonists are a pretty hardy bunch. It's also, I mean, it moves into some slightly supernatural areas, and I don't think that you need something to be supernatural to be a horror. You know, slasher films are generally regarded as horror films, and they often don't have a supernatural element. But that said, I feel like I would have, I mean, this is personal preference, and I could see why you wouldn't insert this in a post-apocalyptic genre piece, but I guess I wanted a few more supernatural flourishes. Like, there was a bit where Claire talks about she imagines seeing the pest in its embodied form, and I was very up for seeing that. You know, I wanted a good conversation with the pest, even in a dream sequence. And this might be partly because I've been playing the alpha of Pathologic 2, the plague simulator by Russian game studio Ice Pick Lodge. And in that, this Russian steppe town from about 1910 is beset by the sand plague. And you do talk with an embodied form of the sand plague, which looks a bit like a kind of cross between a plague doctor and a carrion crow,
suppose. That's what I would imagine it looked like.
I guess I kind of wanted more of that kind of thing, perhaps. I guess also I didn't fundamentally find it scary. Did you?
I found the character of the master pretty creepy. He's a creepy guy. And I thought there was quite a good sense of built-up dread surrounding him. In that...
That's true.
The various... horrible things he's up to, but we know that our plucky band of survivors are making their way to him.
Yes. Did you want to read? I mean, you mentioned the blood drinking.
Yeah, I'll just explain a little bit more about the master.
Okay.
So he's we're very, very thoroughly in the devious adult authority figures area of children's horror. For one thing, he claims that he's the only adult left. Although it's up for debate whether he is any more sane than any of the cured. But by positioning himself in this way, that the children in the book are uniquely at his mercy, both in the fact that in the short term, them are traumatized and hungry and frightened, but also in the long term, he's promising a cure for pest that they will die of if they don't find it. But this is where we came to my bold claim of the week.
A claim of the week!
The master claims that drinking the blood of blue-eyed children will keep him alive because of the recessive gene. And it's unclear how much he himself believes this, but at times he does seem to. But as one of the characters says, otherwise, the blue-eyed blood is a cure stuff is nonsense. He just likes killing blue-eyed children. But, yeah.
I mean, he's basically coded as being unsavory in all the various ways that an adult might be unsavory towards children, I suppose.
Yes. And it doesn't explicitly...
It doesn't move into the kind of sexual abuse, but this is always lingering unpleasantly in the background, I'd say. Yeah.
So I'll read the extract where he drinks a child's blood.
Good for you.
Because that's what we like here on this podcast. Somewhere behind the mansion, the master could hear the chugging of the generator. The oven was at just the right temperature, and Britta put in the cake. Eliza cut vegetables. A child named Dante was helping her. The master was watching her handle the knife when it skittered off the potato she was holding and embedded itself deep in her hand. Eliza made no sound. She pulled the knife out, and the blood began to flow freely down her arm in a spiral of red against milk white. "Put cold water on it," said Britta. She moved quickly, a dishcloth in her hand, but the master got to Eliza first. What he felt was not an irresistible urge, but the workings of cold calculation. The blood streaming out of Eliza's hand was enough to keep pest at bay for 6 months, maybe more. The master was free of Sitka AZ-13, oh yes, but as long as the disease is in the world, he needed, what to call it, boosters. Britta was the only one that the master trusted with knowledge about the boosters. Boosters meant ingesting some blood from the right little girl. Boosters were part one of the process that left him happy and healthy. Part two was purely recreational. Britta didn't need know about that. He cherished her ignorance. Eliza bled. The master caught Britta's eye. He suddenly turned away and pinned Eliza to the wall. Britta and Doug looked on as he bent down and licked the blood off her arm, moving his tongue right up into the wound. Dante had stopped chopping vegetables and he looked horrified, but Doug, without saying a word, went and stood against the door so none of the others could come in. Eliza was crying, but she did not scream. For clarification, we do not like this on that podcast.
I mean, no, I don't like the taste of blood anyway. Very irony.
So in that extract, he seems to be persuading himself that this is a genuine cure.
I mean, it's tricky, right? Because obviously, like, his beliefs seem founded on, like, batshit magic race science, basically. Yet the world seemingly is not totally immune to magic, perhaps, in an early modern sense. So one thing I found interesting to discover is that the author is a Shakespeare academic. And there seems to be a sense in the book that the pest has kind of returned civilization to the early modern period, and that things that made sense or had value or worked for people in the early modern period start to work again now. So one instance of this is dreams. Dreams in the book tend to take the form of prophecy, and there's actually some discussion in the dialogue that now that pest has happened, dreams mean something again. I thought this was really interesting, the idea that early modern belief systems were perhaps suited to a certain kind of hard-knock agrarian survivalism, and that this sort of belief in them made them true, in a sense. Shall we give a spoiler warning for what eventually does cure Pest? Okay, so spoilers, so skip ahead about 2 minutes. It's leeches. Leeches drain the bad blood and cure the affected kids of Pest. I thought that was really interesting because, yeah, it reflects a kind of early modern belief that suddenly makes sense and it works. I did wonder if there was a certain... I mean, I think this is at play with... So, like, my brother, for instance, you know, he irritatingly claims that, you know, he's quite glad about the climate change and the coming apocalypse, because he's like, yeah, no, it'll be good, because returning to, you know, the hard graft, you know, the survival out, you know, where men were men, I guess. And it's really, he's a very lazy person, is my brother. Realistically, he doesn't want to have to hunt his own food and skin animals. He wants to be playing on his Xbox. But I find it interesting that often there does seem to be a perverse strain of wish fulfillment at the heart of post-apocalyptic stories. You know, people really enjoy playing Fallout. I don't know if this is a kind of return to a less mediated world where you've got a very direct relationship with your surroundings and the objects you use. You know, everything is purposeful, everything is in its right place. You know where you are with a bit of flint in your hand and a fire out of some twigs. Whereas, you know, who knows how computers work? But I do think that, you know, people obviously tend to assume that they're going to be the one who survives, rather.
I don't know. It sounds awful. I'd hate to be a post-apocalyptic survivor.
Oh yeah, same here. And I think this kind of perverse fetishization of it does really come from a place of privilege, to be honest, because the fact is that climate change is already affecting the poorest regions of the globe and causing mass migration. I find it, I don't know. I'm not saying that's necessarily in play in the book, but there is a hint of the world returning to a kind of pre-lapsarian state, basically. Like, Jem has a line of dialogue, which I thought was quite nice, where he says, he mentions that you see a lot of deer around, and he says, oh, maybe this is our chance to start over, and, you know, this time we'll actually respect the natural world. But, yeah, part of me feels like this kind of narrative's quite dangerous, because I think there's an increasing awareness that, you know, the apocalypse isn't going to just happen overnight. It's unlikely that we are going to have this moment where suddenly everything's terrible but we can start again. Rather, it's a very slow process by which lots of different factors slowly get worse and humans slowly try to adapt.
If you actually want a more realistic and consequently horrific take on post-apocalyptic fiction, as Octavia Butler, the Parable of the Sower and the Parable of the Talents, which is just devastatingly brutal. But I mean, it's amazing, but in there,
are they four kids? I can't remember. Or
the,
teens,
the protagonist is a teens, she starts as a teenager anyway, but
okay.
You know, they do, in that, they do try and make a new sort of religious self-sufficient community, you know, in the sort of chaos of what's happened. But it doesn't go smoothly, let's say.
It's like, It's like those buckyball communes in the 60s in the deserts of California. They sound great, but then I remember there was an Adam Curtis documentary, and, you know, he's pretty libertarian, so I try to take him with a bit of a pinch of salt. But the people interviewed suggested that it didn't really work out that well, and actually you got lots of power abuses and other unpleasantness, and sadly, despite the utopian desires of those involved, it was pretty crappy.
Yeah, and I think possibly what is maybe a little, goes a little unrealistically smoothly in this novel is how immediately, harmoniously the children get along.
Yeah, because teenagers... Yeah. Sorry, teens, if you're listening. I'm sure you're lovely, teenage listeners. But a lot of teenagers aren't great, as I'm sure you know. And, yeah, these are all thoroughly good kids, basically. And not just good, but also, I mean, you know, they're having to put up with just pooing in a ditch, you know? Like, and they're still generally pretty decent to one another, really. I think this was, for me, something of an issue that I guess the horror I tend to like, and again, I think this is sort of personal taste, there's always the threat of the protagonist, I don't want to say necessarily succumbing to evil, but perhaps recognising certain weaknesses in themselves, or that good and evil aren't so easily demarcated, that it's less about evil than it is about chaos, perhaps, and things going wrong. Whereas one thing that frustrated me about this book is that when we have a character who seemingly is a human and not one of the cured, who does something evil, it's revealed that they are actually cured and thus are other to human, that the reason for their evil behaviour is basically because of this, the side effects of this ineffective cure. So I was thinking of the character of Darian.
Who they invite into their shelter. Let's see, he says he, you know, he's just another child like them, but who makes off in the morning with their pig and Miri, the youngest girl, and who they find later around a campfire with the butchered pig and Miri tied up, and it's really quite disturbing.
It's the part of the book I found most disturbing, because it doesn't sort of say what his intent is, but various bad things are insinuated, and yeah, he's sort of, I guess, positioned as a corrupted child figure. He might have turned 18, so there's this sort of anxiety about the innocent childhood having fallen away to reveal a kind of corrupted adulthood.
But yeah, he is. Then they find the patch behind his neck and realise that he was a cured all along, which means we don't have the sort of the thing like sort of in The Walking Dead, or for example, you know, at first the threats are the walking dead, are the undead, and then after a while other humans become much more dangerous. They work out how to deal with the zombies, but other humans are evil and unpredictable in ways that they are much more threatening to them. But we don't really have any sort of narrative like that in this book.
No, I mean, to be fair, that goes right back to Night of the Living Dead, from the 1960s. So you could say that at this point it's a bit of a cliche, and perhaps the author was deliberately resisting this by not having it, that it was the humans who were evil all along. Yeah, I think I just wish that the evil hadn't been quite so clearly demarcated, which is not to say that sometimes there are people who do thoroughly evil things. It's not that I believe, you know, I'm not saying, oh, everyone's fallible, everyone's just as fallible, we're all as bad as the master, really. You know, I don't believe that. But I did find the kids a little bit too perfect for me, I think. But again, personal taste, and, you know, just because, you know, I like my morally conflicted characters doesn't mean that every teenage reader necessarily does.
Do you have a texture of the week?
Better, do I have any objects with which to make appropriate texture of the week sounds is the question. I'll make a sort of slurping, moaning, post-apocalyptic sounds. I mean, that's probably horrible. Yes, I do actually, and it's quite a nice little texture. It's just one image in the book that I really liked, and I think it's meant to be a bit creepy, but there's a description of butterflies, like butterflies pinned in a display case, and the pins are described as looking like drops of mercury that have fallen onto the butterflies. I thought that was just a really... I mean, the texture of mercury is obviously endlessly fascinating. And, yeah, a very vivid image, I thought.
I also have a similarly quite a nice texture. Well, I have a nice one and a nasty one.
Okay, yes.
But my nice texture is... at the beginning, Claire has a little birdie called Chuppy, and says she had taken Jane Eyre and she also took Chuppy, who liked to peck at the margins of the book, leaving behind holes that seemed full of meaning.
Oh, yeah. That is rather lovely.
I don't think there's lots. Thing I really like about this book, I think, is there's lots of nice images and little turns of phrase.
That's true, and I think, you know, sometimes the kids don't quite talk like kids, perhaps, but I do like some of the little phrases they come up with. There's quite a few moments where the kids use just slightly the wrong word, or invent a word, or that's misunderstandings, which were quite charming.
Do you want to hear my horrible texture?
Yeah, I probably do. Go on then.
It's because we haven't actually talked about any of the body horror surrounding the pest, but it's not very nice, and you get blisters that turn into pustules that spread all over their face. We have a description of one of the cured. It's the woman's face looked like someone had put a thumb down and smeared it.
It reminded me a little bit of the Charles Burns graphic novel Black Hole. Have you read that one?
Yes, we read it together in Borders in York.
Oh, yeah, one of the many, many comics we read in Borders before it closed down because people were reading books in Borders rather than buying them.
Yes.
That's how you fight the capitalist machine. Use your local bookstop as a library. But, yeah, like I remember that the disease in Black Hole kind of creates, I guess... I suppose facial mutations, you'd say. I mean, you could argue that this borders into a kind of creating horror out of disfigurement somehow I think it manages to skirt that, but I'm not quite sure why. I guess, you know, the people never feel dehumanised because of these changes, I suppose.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think there is a moment where they come across a cured whose face is all sort of swollen, and one of the little girls says, "Oh, it's a thing." So,
I don't know.
I think, it's not. It's not a massive part of it, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, you know. I think whether, you know, does body horror always risk being ableist? Mm. You know, because it tends to play into anxieties around the body, and sometimes these may be anxieties that able-bodied people have, and often it will be about bodies changing in such a way that is deemed undesirable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know if it's sort of inherently...
Not Tetsu Iron Man, though.
No, not Tetsu Iron Man, which is obviously very progressive and sort of joyously queer. Yeah. If you're a kid, you probably can't watch Tetsu Iron Man. But if you're not and haven't, watch it. It's freaking glorious.
Do you have anything else to add?
No, I mean, I'm aware that I might have sounded a bit down on the book overall, and I think that's just, it's not my kind of thing. I do think it has stretches of quite evocative and engaging writing. Mm. And, you know, I certainly kept turning the pages, so I was interested in how it was going to turn out. I think I'm just not very keen on the post-apocalyptic genre, to be honest. Or I prefer it really within the medium of video games. Mm. You know, I kind of want to be the I want to be the one trying, generally not very well, to survive and collecting resources. But I think if you're into that genre and it's something you enjoy, then I'd recommend it.
Hmm.
How about you?
Yeah, I did enjoy it. I think this is actually the second time I've read it. I think on a reread, I was reading more carefully, so I sort of noticed a few things that I was a bit like about. But I still I think it's really well written and interesting. Mostly I really like the writing. I like the details and the images that she comes up with.
And certainly has a very memorable villain in the figure of the Master.
Yes.
Who's very, very unambiguously evil.
We didn't actually, we sort of touched on the sort of eugenics aspect, but didn't actually discuss that.
I mean, to be fair, I think the book somewhat sketches over it. It's certainly referred to. In a sense, the Master's kind of in the archetype of evil Nazi scientist, basically.
Yeah. It's not explicitly referred to, but he talks about wanting to find blue-eyed children and mate them. That sounds horrible. I'm sorry, but breed them. Mm. Make more blue-eyed children. You know, which is a fairly unambiguously
Nazi thing to do.
Tinted thing, yes. It's not developed very, very far in that direction.
No, which I don't think it could be, really. I mean, this is a young adult book, essentially. So, understandably, I guess it circles those issues. I'm going to try to think of a sign-off. Did you want to do the credits? And I mean, if you do the credit, you could do it quite slowly.
Our theme tune is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork is by Letty Wilson. You can contact us on Twitter at StillScaredPod, or email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. You can even rate and review us on iTunes.
Yeah, please do that, actually. That'd be nice. You don't have to, but, you know.
Do you have a sign-off for us, Adam?
I guess sleep well, creepy kids. Neither pest nor master be. Goes with the kind of early modern old English. Okay. Sallow dreams, creepy kids. Neither pest nor master be.
See you next time.
Bye.